Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
By the early 1990s, Japanese car culture was no longer a secret. Around the world, it stopped being something you heard about and became something you could see. In parking lots, at drag strips, in the pages of magazines, kids in America were building cars that looked like they came straight out of Osaka. The philosophy, the obsession with precision, the willingness to strip a car down to nothing in pursuit of speed. All of it had traveled. In the last episode, we talked about how Japanese media began to find its way out into the wider world. But that was just a seed. And what grew from it didn't just survive. It mutated into something new, with the help of a little thing called the World Wide Web.
Welcome. You've got mail.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Pass Gas. My name is Nolan Sykes. I've got some mail for you. Golden Age of JDM. It's episode 8. We're talking about the effects of the internet on car culture at large through the lens of the Japanese car industry in this episode. We're going to talk about the early days, a more humble internet, a simpler time on the internet. Now, the internet is so ingrained into every part of our lives. It sounds strange to even call it the World Wide Web because of Wi-Fi and cell towers and all that kind of, you have constant internet access. You have constant notifications because of the internet. Like, it's almost hard to think of it as something separate from real life at this point. And that's a bit of a cliche, I will admit, but it's true. And in this episode, we're going to talk about those earlier days, you know, what it used to be like. If you've been listening to this new season from the beginning, I'd really like to give you a big thank you. This season has been a lot of work, but it's really meant a lot to us, and it's been a lot of fun recording every single one of these episodes. If you would like to listen on other platforms besides the one you're on right now, we have a YouTube channel. Go ahead and subscribe to that, Donut Podcast. If you're on YouTube right now, we are also on every big podcast platform out there. And please give us a review on your platform of choice. Would really like to hear what you guys think of this new format. Just tell us how we're doing. All right, so let's get into the show and maybe you'll see what I'm talking about. The early internet ran on message boards. Simple websites where people gathered in threads with names like SR20 Swap Wiring Help or Best Turbo for B-Series? Every conversation started with a single question. Most posts ended with a small block of text listing the poster's car and mods, basically a resume made out of parts. It was called a signature, and they usually went something like this. 1998 Civic EX, B18 Swap, Greddy Turbo Kit, Hondata ECU. These forums were full of sub-forums devoted to things like engine builds, suspension, or general troubleshooting. Sometimes there'd be off-topic threads for relationship help. These were real communities where you could hang out from your bedroom instead of having to go out into the real world. There are also regional sections where people from the same city could organize meets. Basically, it was like Reddit with fewer trolls. This was before the centralization of the internet, you know? How many forums do you visit these days that aren't Reddit-centric, you know? That's what's kind of sad and kind of depressing about Reddit. It's a great resource, but also it's kind of caused the death of so many forums across the internet and the loss of so much valuable information, so many decades old forum posts now gone, I think because of Reddit. What made the whole system work was the way information built up over time. Say you wanted to swap a B18C into your Civic. Well, you'd start a thread, ask the question, and wait. A few replies would trickle in. One person gives you a quick answer. Days pass, more replies show up. Over time, these threads would become complete working guides built by complete strangers. The crazy thing was that most of these people had never been to Japan. Many had never even seen the cars that inspired them in person. And yet, the influence was obvious. To understand how deep that influence went, you have to go back to where the American import scene started. In the late 80s and early 90s, American performance culture was still built around the muscle car. V8s, quarter mile times, and a culture centered on displacement and straight line speed. Car shows featured Camaros, Mustangs, and Chevelles. Magazines spoke the language of cubic inches and carburetors. But for a generation that grew up after the gas crisis, that formula was getting old. These were kids who grew up with Honda and Mazda as household names, whose older siblings were wrenching on Celicas instead of Plymouths. Naturally, the old guard hated this. Import cars got mocked constantly. They were called rice burners and written off as flimsy economy cars. But that mockery only helped build a counterculture. And every counterculture needs a champion. One of the most important was Frank Choi. Choi was a Korean-American car enthusiast who became a SoCal promoter out of pure necessity. He spent the end of the 80s building up a nitrous-fed Mazda RX-3. And finally brought it out to the LA County Raceway in Palmdale. Rest in peace. He was turned away, told the track was for scheduled sessions only. He called back weeks later to book a session properly and got the runaround again. Choi figured out what was actually going on. It wasn't a scheduling problem. It was that his car and the people he ran with didn't look like the racers the staff was used to dealing with. So, he stopped trying to go through the front door. He went directly to the track owner, made his case in person, and walked out with a rental agreement. He wanted an event where imports and only imports would get their shot. And now, he had the venue to make it happen. In 1990, he put together the first Battle of the Imports. He promoted it the only way he could at the time. A photocopier and flyers, which he handed out at street races. Word traveled the same way the cars did, by word of mouth and highway miles. After a modest first event, Frank Choi's brainchild grew steadily through the decade. And then, just as the Battle of the Imports was hitting its peak, the internet suddenly amplified it. Message boards and forums let enthusiasts share builds and race results in real time. Fourth and fifth generation Honda Civic hatchbacks had become the scene's weapon of choice, influenced by the Konjo racers of Osaka. Named for the urban expressway loop they used as their unofficial racetrack, these were drivers who had made the Civic into something close to a religion. Strip the interior to nothing, tune the engine, push the car to its limits in tight and dangerous spaces. American racers picked up that philosophy and ran with it. Civics were cheap, light, and easy to modify. For young guys working on tight budgets, they were the perfect starting point. Everything that wasn't necessary got removed. Interior stripped down to a single racing seat, a steering wheel, and a bare dashboard. Sound systems, carpeting, rear seats, door panels, gone. You know, what's really interesting, though, about the Civic is that in Japan, that was actually the car that the wealthier guys built. it's so backwards here in the US where the Civic is the cheap car. But in Japan, there was actually a lottery system in order to buy one of these things. It was a more expensive car over there, which seems so strange. But we had our friend Jun Takahashi and Kai Mira at the office, owner of Rocket Bunny over in Japan. They were here visiting the office a couple weeks ago. It's just really interesting. What we consider a cheap car is actually in Japan a more expensive build, and vice versa. The rear-wheel drive cars over in Japan were the ones that were more budget-friendly compared to here. Very, very interesting. Needless to say, my flabbers were gasted. So from there, things got even more extreme. Racers started pulling off the entire hatch and rear bumper assembly and replacing them with trash bags. Stretched across the rear opening and taped down tight, they created what the community started calling trash bag hatchbacks. I've never seen this. That sounds insane. It looked ridiculous, but the idea was weight reduction, which at the drag strip is everything. Tape became a serious tool. Strips were pressed into gaps between the front bumper, hood, and fenders, on the theory that it would smooth out the airflow and reduce drag. The philosophy was simple. If it might make the car faster, it was worth a shot. A lot of this experimentation got documented and debated on internet forums like Honda Tech. Thousands of enthusiasts shared results, compared setups, and built on each other's ideas. It was like a decentralized engineering lab, where enough collective trial and error could turn a duct tape experiment into standard practice. But not everyone was impressed. And many of the loudest critics weren't even from the V8 crowd. Honda racers quickly developed a new rival inside the import world. The Mitsubishi Eclipse and the Eagle Talon, known together as DSMs, short for Diamond Star Motors, were built through a joint venture between Mitsubishi and Chrysler. Engineered by Mitsubishi, designed by Chrysler, and assembled in Illinois. This meant that the import scene's biggest internal rivalry was between two groups driving Japanese-influenced machines. The difference was that DSMs came from the factory with turbocharged engines and all-wheel drive, which gave them a big head start in power and traction. Dude, these freaking DSMs still are just nasty cars, man. They're not as common because a lot of them, I think, have been like scrapped or whatever, but when you see like a nice Mitsubishi, just know that the owner is really about that life. Like, you can't casually get into Mitsubishis. It is a legit lifestyle. It takes so much dedication and research to get these cars to be healthy in the first place. So when you see one that's nice and like running, that deserves props for sure. Another product of the DSM Diamond Star Motors collaboration was the Dodge Stealth / Mitsubishi 3000 GT twin turbo V6. Like grand touring car, notoriously difficult to work on because they put a big engine into a small engine bay, hard to find parts for as well. I think Justin actually had one. Him and his brothers, I think, had a Stealth at one point. Anyway, the contrast between the Honda and Mitsubishi camps was easy to see. Honda racers were chasing performance through weight reduction and DIY engineering, whereas DSM owners valued polish and factory muscle. Things came to a head at a Diamond Star Shootout, one of the biggest DSM gatherings in the country. Tuning legend Dave Muescher set up a table and started selling rolls of duct tape labeled Honda Race Tape. Photos quickly circulated through the import media world, most notably in Turbo Magazine. But what could have been a full embarrassment turned into a turning point. The mockery pushed Honda builders to care more about how their cars looked, not just how they performed. Cleaner engine bays, tighter body panels, more refined builds overall. The internet and the growing network of tuning magazines helped those ideas move quickly. Pushed by the rivalry with the DSM crowd, the scene started growing up. The backyard experimentation phase was giving way to something more serious, and Honda itself took notice. According to their head of public relations, Kurt Antonius, the duct tape movement and the Civic's rise in general weren't things Honda had planned for or seen coming. it caught them off guard. It wasn't until Honda started showing up at the annual SEMA show in Las Vegas that the scale of it became clear. Everyone had a Civic, and nearly every aftermarket company on the floor had one on display. The culture of events like SEMA kept growing in ways nobody expected. Modified imports filled convention centers and parking lots. Judges walked rows of builds. But the atmosphere was nothing like a traditional car show. Several worlds had collided at once. So the SEMA show was started back in 1963. It's an aftermarket trade show. It's the Specialty Equipment Manufacturers Association. It is a car show, ostensibly, because there are thousands of cars in attendance. But it really is a networking event. Lots of industry leaders there. A lot of manufacturers, a lot of both aftermarket and OEM show up. From the beginning, it was really mostly focused on American aftermarket manufacturers, you know. But up until this exact point in history, it was really just focused on hot rods and muscle cars and American manufacturers. But now, with the rise of Japanese cars getting so popular on the market, they're going to start trickling in. Today, it's just a beautiful mix of all kinds of cars from all over the world. At this point, though, it's part trade show, part drag race, part nightclub. This didn't happen by accident. Promoter Ken Miyoshi saw early on that import culture had everything it needed to be a real spectacle. Starting in the late 1990s and growing fast into the early 2000s, his Hot Import Nights events combined car shows with pure energy. DJs, massive sound systems, neon-lit cars under colored lights, models posing next to heavily modified Integra Type Rs and A80 Supras. Everything about it was youth-driven. The quiet rows of restored classics had been replaced by a scene built around speed, music, fashion, and spectacle, which made for an interesting contrast with where all this had started. In Japan, tuning culture was almost entirely about performance. Cars were built for a specific goal, like lower lap times, better balance, harder engineering. Mechanical precision was the point. In the United States, the focus got wider. Performance still mattered, but so did how the car looked. Builders started experimenting with wild body kits, bright paint, vinyl graphics, and custom lighting. Cars became a way to express something personal, and the tuner scene grew up alongside hip-hop, club culture, and urban nightlife. The cars became part of that same visual world. So much of what was happening came down to a simple idea. The car is an extension of who you are. But while most American enthusiasts were working on their Civics in driveways, there was another car out there that lived almost entirely as a rumor. A car everyone wanted, and almost no one could have. Until they could. Big thank you to our sponsor, longtime sponsor of our podcast here at Donut Media, Rocket Money. Rocket Money can track subscriptions and has the ability to cancel unwanted ones from within the apps with a few taps, saving users over $800 million in canceled subscriptions. You know who's part of that $880 million? Me, your boy. I've used Rocket Money in the past to cancel some stuff. Over the years, you just sign up for trials and whatever services that you maybe forgot about. It ends up just, you look at your credit card and you're like, why am I spending so much money? I haven't even used my credit card this month. What's going on? Well, you might have subscriptions that you are still using, even if you're not actually using. You're paying for them, but you're not using them. There's a point there when I was like, oh my God, I've got a pretty good amount of credit card debt here, and it felt very overwhelming. Luckily, thanks to services like Rocket Money and just, you know, being smarter with your money, not making impulse purchases, I was able to get out of that. And now I'm very much on top of my finances. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Let Rocket Money help reach your financial goals faster. Join at rocketmoney.com/pastgas. That's rocketmoney.com/pastgas. Thank you so much, Rocket Money. Big thank you to Lumi Labs for sponsoring this episode. Consistent, mellow, and super delicious, Lumi gummies are specifically designed to make you feel good, not stoned. Whether you're looking for an end-of-the-day de-stressor, a midday mood boost, or help getting the best sleep ever, Lumi Gummies has a strain that's right for you. They also come in 1 milligram or 5 milligram gummies, so you can get the exact dose you're looking for. Dude, I'm going to need to get my hands on some of these. I got a pretty stressful job, dude. And honestly, it's been affecting my sleep a little bit. I need to get some of these. So, whether you need some help relaxing or help sleeping, Lumi's got a gummy for you. They got their hybrid strawberry cookies gummy. They've also got their sativa orange cream cookie gummy to help lock in. Lumi gummies are available nationwide. Go to lumigummies.com. That's L-U-M-I gummies and use code PASSGAS for 30% off your order. That's L-U-M-I gummies.com. Code PASSGAS. LumiGummies.com. Code PASSGAS. Thank you so much, Lumi Gummies. Okay, you're back in your family's computer room. The computer has its own room. You've already yelled at your sister for picking up the phone, interrupting your Quake 3 match that you were in. Every photo you have is downloaded line by line. You've got 56K. Your mom buys like fruit snacks from the grocery store. Things are good. You close out of the Honda message boards and head on over to the Nissan side of the internet. Fresh Alloy had become a serious hub for the discerning Nissan enthusiast. It was one of the first English language forums where Americans were having real conversations about the SR20 DET engine. Zilvia was built around the 240SX and had become the home base of the early American drift community. And across the Pacific, Skylines Australia held a unique spot. Because of Australia's more lenient import laws, enthusiasts there could legally own cars that American fans could only imagine. Cars like the Nissan Skyline GTR. It showed up in forum threads, magazine features, racing videos, and late-night parking lot conversations. People debated its horsepower, its technology, and what was actually happening under the hood. There was the R32, known as Godzilla, the car that brought the GTR name back to life. It was developed under chief engineer Naganori Itu, the man Shinichiro Sakurai had spent decades training to carry the Skyline forward. Then came the R33. Bigger, more refined, and built for stability at high speed. It took what the R32 started and pushed it further. And the sexiest Mac Daddy of them all, the R34. The one that made everyone stop talking. Compact, aggressive, sharper than anything that came before it. Of all three of those, I actually had the best time driving the R33. It's kind of slept on, but also, I don't know, something about it. Maybe it's because I wasn't as stressed driving that one. Driving an R34 is stressful because, like, that car was worth a lot of money, and I was scared to scratch it. So maybe that's why I didn't have as good a time. All amazing cars. Every generation of the Skyline carried the same reputation. Technologically sophisticated and brutally fast. At the core of that was Nissan's RB26 engine. A twin-turbocharged, straight-six paired with an all-wheel drive system that gave the car grip and acceleration that felt almost unfair. Most people got their first look at the Skyline in the early 90s, when the R32 entered international touring car competition and was so dominant and fearsome that Australians nicknamed it Godzilla. The name stuck, and so did the legend. We talked about that whole story in episode 6. If for some reason this is the first episode that you're listening to in the series, definitely go back and get the context, or just keep listening to this. I'm not your dad. I don't care. Anyway, there was just one problem. You couldn't buy one in the U.S. Every car sold in the United States has to meet federal safety and emission standards. Nissan had built the Skyline GTR for the Japanese market and never certified it for America. They didn't think it made financial sense. Without going through the certification process, the car couldn't be imported, registered, or driven legally on U.S. roads. For a while, the Skyline seemed destined to remain a fantasy for American drivers. Then, a small Californian company found a loophole. They were called Motorex. Motorex was founded by Hiroaki Nanahoshi, who believed the Skyline could be brought to America legally through a process called federalization. The idea was that an independent importer could modify a foreign car to meet U.S. safety standards, and if it passed, it could be registered and driven on public roads. In theory. In practice, federalization was a brutal process. It involved crash tests, structural modifications, thick stacks of paperwork. It was a black hole. You'd submit everything, wait months, and then get back a new list of requirements. It was the kind of process designed to make you impatient. And Motorex got impatient. Nanahoshi was under financial pressure. His startup money, around $1 million from a Japanese dealership investor, came with expectations. So Motorex focused on R33 Skylines, which they could import in larger numbers at a lower cost. Those cars got crash tested by JK Technologies and cleared by the DOT, then put up for sale. At this point, business looked great. The now famous McNasty GTR made its public debut on November 15, 1999. It was a silver R32 GTR. It had never been seen on American roads before. To show it off, Motorex launched a website and hit the road on a tour around the country. Orders started coming in. More Skylines started shipping over from Japan. And Hiroaki Nanahoshi was living large. He started spending his nights not at the office, but at Japanese hostess bars, running through the company's money. Now, if you've never been to a Japanese hostess bar, it's where you basically pay women to be impressed with you and to, like, pretend like you're the man. Even though this guy was, like, doing well and had a cool, like, job, like, he's still paying women to, like, pay attention to him, which I think is uniquely lame. And this dude would spend, like, 15 grand a night some nights. As luck would have it, Motorex wasn't in a position to support that lifestyle. They were still a small operation selling cars that most enthusiasts couldn't afford, which ran around $80,000 each, and that's in 99 money, so like now that's like, it's like 160 grand probably. But Nanahoshi was riding high, partly because Motorex had just gotten a big boost from a film franchise that was about to blow up. But more on that a little later. They had also built a real reputation in import circles as the company that did what no one else could. And when they suddenly started bringing in R34 Skylines, it seemed like they had pulled off the impossible. It turned out, it was impossible. Remember that approval process full of paperwork? The really thick stack? Well, Motorex noticed their application had a clause allowing quote-unquote substantially similar vehicles to be added to the same certification. They used that language to claim the R32 and R34 were close enough to the R33 to qualify. They weren't. Only the R33 had been crash tested. Federal regulators had access to the specs for all three cars, and if they had looked carefully, they would have caught it right away. But they didn't. The application went through, and a time bomb got buried under the whole operation. Making things worse, Nanahoshi had become impossible to rely on. He'd disappear for days at a time. Customers would be told their cars were ready before the cars had even left Japan, and he was allegedly setting up private Skyline sales on the side and keeping the money. Then, in 2005, the LA County Sheriff's Department opened an investigation after a neighboring performance shop called Blast Racing reported that two customer cars had been stolen. The case took a sharp turn when one of Blast's tuners was attacked with a stun gun. He told police that Nanahoshi himself was behind it. When investigators searched Nanahoshi's apartment, they found packaging that matched the taser. Nanahoshi was arrested, and bond was set at $1 million. By the time police had searched Motor X's garage, it had already been picked clean. Word about the bust had spread fast enough that thieves had broken in and driven off every Skyline they could find. The final blow to Motor X came from regulators. They had finally noticed that the R32s and R34s they had been selling were not substantially similar to the R33 that had actually been crash tested. Certification was pulled, cars were confiscated from customers, some were destroyed. By 2006, Motor X was finished and the Skyline loophole closed with it. The car itself lived on. You could find the Skyline GTR in Gran Turismo. You could find grainy photos on Fresh Alloy. And if that wasn't enough, Hollywood had been watching the whole time.
Smoke 'em. The Fast and the Furious, rated PG-13, at theaters Friday.
Big thank you to our sponsor this week, Blue Chew. The future of erectile function is here. Blue Chew Gold is changing the way millions of men are having sex in 2026. The new arousal-boosting formula combines passion and performance into one tablet that dissolves under your tongue for super-fast onset. No more waiting for a pill to kick in. No more moments ruined by performance anxiety. Just the results you want when you want them. Most ED meds only focus on blood flow, but Blue Chew Gold goes further by combining two ingredients for blood flow with two for mental arousal and connections, so you're not just physically ready, you're actually in the mood. This type of innovation is why Blue Chew Gold is the number one brand in erectile function. The process is simple and all online. Get started today at bluechew.com and go for gold. Discover your options at bluechew.com. And we've got a special deal for our listeners right now. When you buy 2 months of Blue Chew Gold, you get the third for free with promo code PASTGAS. That's promo code PASTGAS. Visit bluechew.com for more details and important safety information. And we thank Blue Chew for sponsoring this podcast. Big thank you to our sponsor this week, longtime sponsor of our podcast here at Donut Media. It's Shopify. If you have an online business and you want to take your e-commerce to the next level, you already know that Shopify is the way to go. But if you don't know, well, let me tell you why that is. Shopify is the e-commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. From household names like Gymshark, Allbirds, Chubbies, Heinz, and Mattel to startup businesses just like yours, they do it all. Shopify makes it super easy to get started with your own design studio. With hundreds of ready-to-use templates, Shopify helps you build a beautiful online store that matches your brand style. They'll help you accelerate your efficiency, whether you're uploading new products or trying to improve existing ones. Shopify is packed with helpful tools that write product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography. Best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and beyond. It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/gas. Go to shopify.com/gas. Again, that's shopify.com/gas. Thanks, Shopify. By 2001, Japanese tuner culture had grown into something enormous. It had moved from parking lots and mountain passes into magazines, VHS tapes, video games, and message boards. It had traveled from Osaka to Orange County. It had outgrown the underground. And then Hollywood dropped a match on it. The Fast and Furious traces back to a magazine article. In 1998, journalist Kenneth Lee published a piece in Vibe magazine called Racer X. It put readers directly inside the world of illegal street racing in New York City, a swarm of modified imports taking over Manhattan's Hudson Parkway. A black Nissan 300ZX and a white Mitsubishi Stereon lined up for a mile-long run with traffic standing up behind them. In under a minute, one driver walked away with $7,500. Lee's piece captured the feel of the underground. Night crews shutting down highways, cars chasing speed like it was an addiction, a multicultural scene running across a whole city. It's a really great article. You can still find it. I've read it a couple times, just researching different videos here at Donut. Definitely worth tracking down. Still holds up. Universal Pictures bought the rights to the article. They even offered Lee a chance to write the screenplay. He hung up on them mid-call, so a script got written without him. I wonder how that happened. Someone's probably gaming on the PC, man. They're playing Quake. I miss computer rooms. But the filmmakers ran into a problem quickly. None of them actually knew car culture. If they're going to make this work, they needed someone who did. That someone was Craig Lieberman. Lieberman had gotten into Supras after losing a stoplight race to one in his Mustang GT. Guess if you can't beat him, join him. It's like Blake Snell. He bought a Supra, painted it candy yellow, and loaded it with parts. It had a Stillen body kit, a Rod Millen wing, upgraded brakes, and a full suite of HKS performance upgrades, including bigger intercoolers, an exhaust system, and tuning components aimed at getting more out of that 2JZ engine. The car became a regular at SoCal shows. It took first place at a sports compact car competition. Not long after that, Lieberman brought it to an import show near Manhattan Beach, and a Hollywood production manager walked up and started asking questions. A few days later at lunch, the production manager handed Lieberman the screenplay with a $100 bill clipped to the front. He wanted Lieberman to read it and to make sure they were doing right by the culture. Lieberman read it and laughed. The car lingo was off. The hierarchy made no sense. In one early draft, Paul Walker's character started with a Toyota Supra and later upgraded, quote unquote, to a Mitsubishi Eclipse. It was obvious they needed him. Lieberman helped the filmmakers understand how the tuner world actually worked. Then Universal asked him to find real cars for the production. He put out calls on the internet for weeks, asking if anyone with the right build wanted to be in the film. Whoever showed up, he brought to Universal. The cars they assembled became one of the most recognizable lineups ever put together for a movie. Brian O'Connor's bright green 1995 Mitsubishi Eclipse was the entry point of the tuner world. Affordable, moddable, and already everywhere at street races. Dom Toretto's Mazda RX-7 represented something different. Lightweight, twin turbo rotary, a staple of import magazines and Gran Turismo. Low, sculpted, and unmistakably Japanese. Around them were the cars you'd actually see at a SoCal meet. The Honda Civic, Nissan 240SX, Honda S2000, and the Acura Integra. And then, there was the Skyline. Lieberman had been in touch with MotorX and wanted the GTR to be Paul Walker's car. But he could only get the Skylines on loan, which made building stunt replicas too expensive. A lot of these cars, you have your hero car, which is built really nice. Like, that's something you could take to a show, and like, all the details are very accurate. The car looks amazing. Those are just like for stationary shots where the character's getting in and out of the car. And then you have stunt cars, which are usually way more rudimentary. They look good from like 20 feet, but then you get closer, you're like, oh, it's not a show car. It's meant to be driven hard, jumped over stuff, and bashed around on set. And it's hard to build Skyline stunt cars when you can't get the Skyline in the US. So the GTR got pushed to the side in the first film, driven by a supporting character and shown only briefly. Roads closed, pizza boy. Find another way home. Paul Walker couldn't let the car go, though. He used part of his paycheck from the first film to buy an R34 from MotorX. This is what I would do too, man. The Bayside Blue R34 that shows up in Too Fast, Too Furious is a combination of that real car and purpose-built stunt replicas made on Skyline GTT platforms for the production. So it's a Skyline, just not all-wheel drive. The Fast and the Furious opened in June of 2001 and landed at exactly the right moment. It made $40 million in its opening weekend, not bad, and finished with over $207 million worldwide on a budget of just $38 million. It broke even opening weekend. Can't ask for more than that. That's awesome. For Hollywood, the point was clear. Tuner culture was now mainstream entertainment, And inside the car community, the reaction was immediate. People who had only cared about American muscle suddenly wanted to know everything about import tuning. Exhaust shops got slammed with orders. Teenagers started figuring out how to afford a Supra. Spoiler alert, they couldn't. Not everybody was happy about it. A lot of people inside the actual scene worried the film would hollow things out, that the culture they had spent years building would get flattened into something unrecognizable, that the mainstream version would become the only version. And maybe they weren't wrong. But one thing about the film was surprisingly authentic: its diversity. Long before Hollywood started talking openly about representation, the world in The Fast and the Furious looked a lot like the actual SoCal tuner scene. Late night meets in Los Angeles had always brought together people from different backgrounds. The parking lot, much like Japan's Daikoku, was a place to bring people together through their shared love of tuning. Even the cars themselves represented that blend of influences. Dom Toretto's Dodge Charger could sit beside an icon like the Supra or RX-7, and no one found the combination strange. If anything, the mix was the point. For Japanese enthusiasts, The Fast and the Furious must have been a strange thing to watch. The cars were familiar, but the stories attached to them were not. Whole new identities were being built around machines that had already had deep histories in Japan by people who hadn't been there for any of it. And on top of that, the demand for Japanese imports, aftermarket parts, and tuning culture was now spiking globally, driven by fans who wanted to build what they had seen on screen. It raised a question: if the US could take Japanese car culture and turn it into a worldwide phenomenon, what would happen when Japan responded? That's next time on Past Gas. Guys, thank you so much for listening. Big thank you to our writers, as always: Anthony Harden, Greg Nix, Audrey Holden. Got Joe Weber on the recorder behind me. And I've been your host, Nolan Sykes. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button on the podcast platform of your choice if you're liking what we're doing so far. Don't miss next week's episode. We are entering the final act here. We're right in the heart of it, in the golden era of JDM, and it's been a lot of fun. You can follow me on Instagram at Nolan J. Sykes. Go check out our other podcasts we have here on the Donut Media Podcast Network. We've got Talk Talk Nation. Joe Weber interviews awesome guests from all over car culture. And then we have Jimmy Eats Cars. It's Jimmy Hilton's bi-weekly auto news show. Thank you guys so much. We'll see you next week. Bye.